Hi guys, Pete and Abby from the Therapy Crouch podcast, and we're sponsored by Gemini, Google's personal AI assistant. Listen to this. Gemini, settle this debate. What's the ultimate relationship betrayal? Watching the next episode of your shared favorite TV series alone, or leaving them with all the washing up after a big dinner?
Okay, this is a tough one. Both are pretty bad, but I'd say watching a show without your partner is worse, at least with the dishes. You're not missing out on a shared experience.
I totally agree.
That's what I did last night. I watched 4 episodes without you. It's the ultimate betrayal.
All the time to me.
I know.
Gemini just said it's the ultimate betrayal.
It is the ultimate betrayal. I only did it last night.
Download the Gemini app today to unlock the power of Google AI on your phone.
Looking for a new job? Just go to Indeed and Bob's your uncle. Except we don't really care who your uncle is. Sorry, Uncle Bob. Instead of who you know, we want you to show off what you know. Indeed lets you put your skills and experience front and center so you can match with jobs that fit your talents, not your family tree. Download the Indeed app and start making the world work better for you today.
Afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Drop the Gloves. I got my good friend joining us today, Al Iafredi, all the way. Where are you at now in Michigan, Al?
Plymouth.
All the way from Plymouth, Michigan.
Down yonder from you.
A little bit more south, but not any worse. But still, up north is where you should be. I've been telling you for years. Come up north.
Yeah, it's beautiful up there. I usually spend a week up there in Sutton's Bay with some friends every right around Labor Day. So,
well, if you come up, I'm literally a 9-iron from Sutton's Bay. The next street up is my house, Traverse City, yeah. Sutton's Bay. So let me know you're here. Well, listen, thanks for jumping on. I know you're busy. I know you don't like doing this because you just like to keep a private life when you're away from the spotlight. And you're in the spotlight a lot. Let's be honest. You just got that personality.
Yes. You know, people make fun of the Maple Leafs, but you know, we have some all-star years with the Maple Leafs, and you're going to be doing stuff the rest of your life.
Well, talk about that. Let's jump into it, because I didn't realize you were fourth overall pick, Al. Did you know that in 1984?
Yeah, I knew that. Back then in the early 80s, an agent came to your house 2 or 3 weeks before the draft and said, hey, you know, you're probably going to get drafted pretty high, and it's not like today where they start bird dogging.
That's what I was going to ask. I was going to ask you that because, you know, your draft was solid. Kirk Muller, Eddie Olchuk, you know, Shane Corson, Gary Roberts, but then, of course, the Mario Lemieux drafted number one overall. So I was going to ask, did you guys – now they do the combine, you do the press tour, so there's nothing of that. You didn't get to pal around with Mario Lemieux months before the draft at all?
No, there was none of that. You just kind of were going to go to the draft. My draft was in Montreal, and everyone knew Mario was Mario, you know.
Yeah,
super
right.
Spectacular. And, you know, it was kind of just where you were going to get drafted, because, you know, guys that got drafted in the later rounds, like Patrick Waugh, Brett Hull, Luke Robitaille.
Right? Yeah.
You know, Gary Roberts, but he was a first rounder, but it was a pretty healthy draft. A lot of great players, a lot of Hall of Famers, guys that ended up being in the Hall of Fame, but you really had no idea. You know, I thought it was going to be like Toronto, LA, Buffalo were all kind of picking right in that, the fourth, fifth, sixth picks, kind of where I was slotted to go.
So you show up and you have no idea where you're going. It's not like nowadays you get a pretty good idea of the top 10 because they talk to these kids, they do the interviews, they know everything about them. Like the teams just do so much investigation. What, like Toronto, fourth overall, Toronto, did they come and visit you? Did they do any kind of digging on you?
I did probably an hour interview I guess.
And that's it.
Interrogation type interview. But, you know, I had no idea where I was going. I just loved playing. And I didn't play. I honestly didn't know I was like that good until I was probably 17 when I made the Olympic team as a junior in high school that summer. And an agent came to my house and like talked to me and my parents. Ricky Curran, rip me off Ricky. I affectionately call him my agent. That's his nickname. No, but he's an awesome guy. He was a great agent my whole career. And he wanted to do an interview with me and my parents, and he's talking and telling my parents how good I am and where I'm slotted and all this. My dad looks over at me and he goes, "Hey, you must be pretty good." My dad was busy working all the time, and he never saw me play till I was a midget. Till I was 16.
No kidding.
Yeah, my mom was Mama Bear Alice. She was like, she was, you know, working the two jobs and making sure I had a ride. So it was actually kind of good because I grew up, I had 10 dads, 10 moms. I was kind of like that dog that everyone loved. But by the end of the day, they were like, "All right, you can have
it's enough. Go home."
Yeah.
Was Detroit hockey strong like it is now? Now you got Little Caesars. There's a ton of good stuff going on in that area. How was that? Because you're obviously right across the border. You can play Canadian teams whenever you want, but was it competitive or were you just like a big dude dominating everybody?
We had a powerhouse team, CompuWare. And Little Caesars was the other powerhouse team. And, you know, we'd play each other, and that was really the only competition around here. So we were always in all the tournaments in Ottawa, Toronto, Niagara Falls, Hull, Quebec, out west. You know, we were always going for the stiffest competition to, you know, keep evolving and getting better as a team and as players.
Yeah, so you get drafted, Al, and you go number 4 overall. You know you're making the team right out of camp. Like, because Toronto at that time, let's be honest, not great, right? You show up and it's like, who do they got on defense? They got Bjorn Salming, Hall of Famer. You got Jim Benning. Then not really anybody else. So how was that going from Windsor Spitfires? You're playing in the hockey mecca, Toronto. It's got to be a kind of a culture shock, no?
Oh, yeah. I had no idea what I was in store for. It was, you know, growing up in Detroit, and no disrespect, but self-proclaimed hockey town. I call it Red Wing Town. It's, you know, for most of your career and pretty much the last 75% of my career, Detroit was the best team in the world, right? They were the standard that everyone was chasing to be, and rightfully so, with, you know, Steve Yzerman and the rest of the cast and the way they drafted players and the systematic approach they had to the style of play that they never wavered from that was going to win. And they did. And it's people try to mimic it, but you got to have the personnel to mimic the platform, right?
Yeah.
That's where I think a lot of teams get lost, you know. But, you know, showing up in Toronto as an 18-year-old wasn't like selfies and everyone's all lovey-dovey. It was like you were taking some guy's job, you know. And I was one of the – when I came in, there wasn't a ton of Americans in the league. There was probably less than 50.
Oh, so, no kidding.
Yeah, so coming into the league, it was you got to prove yourself that you're worthy of being in the Wolfpack. And, you know, I did my best. I learned on the job because I basically went from midget hockey to the U.S. national team for 5 months to being drafted and then the NHL.
That's crazy, eh?
I played 12 games of junior after the Olympics. Skipped my senior year at high school, did correspondence courses because a couple of the coaches were professors and teachers. So it was a fast track. And, you know, growing pains for me and the team, you know, with an 18-year-old defenseman that basically thought hockey was an end-to-end rush every time you're on the ice. That's the kind of the way I always kind of played the game. I liked being a defenseman for the opening faceoff and then a rover for the rest of the game. But, you know, it was an awesome experience. I wouldn't trade it in for the world. It was
well, no kidding.
To be drafted by a Canadian team, because being an American guy, you really understand the fabric of the sport is Canadian. No, you know, Americans can argue that point with me, but like the passion for hockey in Canada is unbelievable. And it's
so did you like that? Because don't take offense to this. I'll try to frame it in a good light. You don't seem like a guy who everything is end all be all hockey. Because when I talk to you and when I hang around with you, have a beer with you, whatever, we spend a lot of time together. You get what hockey is. You know, it's a game. You're here to have fun. We try our tail off when we're on the ice, but it's not the end of the world. That's the kind of the sense I get. But was it too much going to Toronto? I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, Al, but I don't know what I'm trying to say here. But you just seem like a super chill guy going into that environment. Were they like, was it pressure? Like, you're our fourth overall pick. We're a bad team. We need you to be the best player on the ice.
You know, luckily for me, I had, you know, Boreas Salming as someone that I idolized growing up. He was the guy when I was, you know, 13, 14, every night I'd listen to the radio, listen to the Maple Leafs Hockey Night in Canada back then. You know, you could watch it on Wednesdays and Saturdays. It was on TV. Mm. So Channel 9. And, you know, Boria was the guy. And then, you know, a couple years later, it was Ray Bourque. And, you know, I got to be partners with two of the guys that I loved as a defenseman growing up. So lucky me. But back to Toronto,
lucky me.
Yeah. So going back to Toronto, it was like, I am pretty laid back, chill guy, but I got to, you know, I've got a switch where I can, you know, go ballistic for sure. But I think that was, you know, I think that was part of the growing pains where, you know, I was, you know, an internally intense guy where, you know, just because I'm not vocal or, you know, bouncing around a room doesn't mean that I'm not focused or, you know how that goes. People can
100%. You know, well, sometimes it's the guys who are the loudest who are the, it's the quiet guys who are usually the most focused and prepared.
Yeah, I'm not saying that, you know, I was that guy, that I was like the most focused guy, but I loved hockey. I wanted to be the best I could be. I tried to do all the things that would help me become, you know, an asset for whatever team I was playing on. And, you know, but being in Toronto, I think it was the right place for me, you know?
Yeah.
Cause it helped me realize the magnitude of, you know, what I have accomplished. Cause I was kind of a freak of nature, man. Like growing up, whether it was on foot in a swimming pool, I mean, you can't tell now. You've only seen me play since I was like 50. So, but like on foot in a pool, whatever sport it was, I was like a rocket. Like my whole game was always speed and shooting. You know, speed and shooting, power and shooting, and you know, so when you have speed as, you know, an asset, that's going to kick open a door fast. You know, I know now there's all the analytics and the hockey sense aspect of it and all that. And they're all valid and they're all equally as important as the other. You know, you throw the guy's heart in there, as you well know, the guy with a huge heart. There's so many factors in what makes up an athlete, you know. Whether a guy like Pavel Datsyuk ever gets nervous or scared, we'll never know. You know what I mean? No one will ever know. Or Mario Lemieux, whether he gets butterflies or is nervous before a game, we'll never know. And I think the people that seem to have the biggest, you know, opinion on that are the ones that never played the game. Oh, guys that get nervous, you can't be nervous for it. Like, It's the people that never played are the ones that are the most vocal about it. You never hear, you know, guys like Wayne Gretzky or Mario Lemieux talk about a guy being nervous or anything, because they're just in another stratosphere. And whether those things affect the ultimate players or not, we'll never know.
Well, but let me ask you about being affected, because you say like you're a freak athlete. You're a big dude. Like, you're 6'3", 6'4", 230, 240. Like, that's a lot of meat to move around. You're the modern, like, before Dustin Byfuglien, that was you. It sounds like, did you ever have coaches or people say, that's not what we need from you, that's not what we want? Because in that age, it was like, off the glass and away we go, you know, stay home defenseman.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that question, because the era of hockey I lived in was no free agency. After 10 years after 10 years, you could be an unrestricted free agent, but there was compensation. And if you signed for market value, the compensation was going to be 5 first round picks. So, you know, you can quote me on this. It was 100% collusion. Like, guys couldn't move. And you were locked up, and depending on how the team developed players, or how you developed yourself, or whether you got traded or not, a lot of those factors were going to be a determining factor on how you developed, because you were kind of there on a team that drafted you, and
yeah,
you know, whether you were being taught the right way or what was most important. But to answer your question, I played in the era where teams spent 75% of the time trying to turn guys that they had into something they weren't. It's like, rather than, okay, this guy is 100% finesse, all offense, we've got that aspect of our game covered, we need that, we need a line of that, he's our guy, let's nourish this flower and pour water on it and fertilizer. But it was like 80% of my time, my first 5-6 years, it was trying to get beaten into being something that I wasn't, where it was, rather than just let this guy fly and do his thing. That was like the oddity.
So is that why your goals go from, you know, 5, 8, 9, then all of a sudden 22? Was that the year where they finally just said, shit, we're not going to be able to control this guy, like, just let him go?
I think, yeah, because, you know, after my fourth year is when I started getting, whatever, 15 to 25 goals a year.
Yeah.
Pretty consistently. And I was just like, I think I was growing as a person and getting more confident. And I was like, you know what? If you're the best player on the ice, what are they going to say? And you're helping your team win and your team is achieving success. You know, and then as my years got later in Toronto, we drafted Luke Richardson, Vince Stamfous, Wendell Clark right after me, Daniel Marowa. We drafted guys, made trades for Eddie Olczyk, stuff like that. Got good players in there, Tom Kervers. We had a great power play near the end of my stint in Toronto. And then, you know, I got traded to Washington, and then, you know, my game elevated to another level because I got transplanted onto a team that was already a really sound defensive team, and they were looking for a guy that what I specialized in, right?
Right. And then they just let you go. They're like, bombs away.
Yeah, it was great. I'd come to training camp. Terry Murray would shake my hand. Do you have a good summer? I'd be like, yeah. He'd be like, all right, have a good year. Then at Christmas, he'd say, Merry Christmas. I'd be like, Merry Christmas. And then for the All-Star break, he'd be like, you're having a great year. You made the All-Star team again. I'd be like, yep, thanks.
And for those of you who don't know, Terry Murray was the head coach of the team.
Yeah, so it was great. It was like they just let me do my thing. They were probably like, okay, leave this guy alone. You know.
So – which is funny. It kind of leads into my next question. When I do an interview, I do a little research. I know you personally, so I don't have to do too much research, but I'm Googling Al Iafrati. And it comes up, well, obviously the mullet, you know, the hardest shot, the hair.
Skullet.
And then it goes.
Mullet.
The nickname, anyone the planet.
Anybody can wear a man bun. Real dudes wear skullets.
Well, okay, let's stay on that. So you're in Washington. And what, like, what's going through your head where you have this patch of hair at the front, then a huge bald spot out, and then like massive mullet out the back?
There was no bald spot.
Al, I can show you a picture I have that I just saw of you doing the hardest shot, and there's a huge like horseshoe bald spot from the hair in the middle. Oh, I got it now. That's why I'm so tall. You can't see mine, but it was there. What was the reasoning behind that hairstyle? You like, let's just break that down.
I think it was like a Samson thing. It was like, I can't cut my hair, man. I won't be able to shoot hard or skate fast. So I'm just going to try and pretend like I'm not going bald.
Did you know it was getting like back then? Because that was the early 90s. Were people coming up to you like, hey, people are talking about your hair? Or was that a later on thing?
No, I think people were like, people didn't want to bother me because I was playing great. They were like, all right, let this weirdo do his thing.
I've never seen a hairstyle like it at all. Like it was, well, I guess I could say Craig Berube had a little bit of a hairstyle like that too, but it's very hard to pull off. And you did it. Did you have the motorcycle back then cruising around Washington with the skullet?
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So I've heard
cruising
stories
around
and we've
on
talked
the bike with the skullet.
Is this true where you're smoking darts during the game between periods in the hallway? Well, tell me about that because it's a different era back then.
Oh, that's funny. We were in Dallas and like all buildings by the late 90s were non-smoking. And I'd gear right down in between periods, like right down to the birthday suit.
Okay.
Walk around with my skates on. And I'm in the hallway smoking a dart in this
in your birthday suit with a towel on, hopefully.
No, I don't think so. And then one of the, I guess, I don't know what you'd call them, arena.
Like, usher attendant or something.
Usher's attendants are like, sir, sir. And I'm like, what? She's like, there's no smoking.
Oh, she.
I'm thinking, really? I'm naked, but there's no smoking, and that's all I'm worried about. It's kind of funny. Guess you had to be there.
But, like, that's not normal. Like, guys, was that the norm? Because, listen, I my first team, my coach was Mario Tremblay, Jacques Lemaire, and so they'd be hacking darts between periods, but that was the coaches. Was that a normal thing for guys? Like, just, okay, period's over, let's go, you know, fire one down. Or was that just you?
Oh, no, my rookie year? I think at the end, at my rookie year, I'm pretty sure at the end of a period, no one was worried about if they were going out for the last shift. They were all jockeying for position at the end of the bench to the tunnel to get to the bathroom quicker so they could hack a dart down. So they were positioning for intermission for a dart.
Everybody
well,
jumping
there was,
off the ice.
There was some worry. There was guys that wanted to play too.
But just compare that to these days where now it's like, have you think hockey, it's lost its personality a little bit? And not that, you know, you guys were publicized, but hockey used to have that certain persona of just like good old boys, you know, like they're there, they're tough as nails. And that's what you did. And now it's just like guys are positioned and you get a protein shake and you get a rub down and a massage between periods. It's completely different now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's definitely different, but it's, you know, it's the evolution of the sport, which is needed, right? I can sit here and say, oh, you know, when I played, I mean, I watched the game on the TV the other day. It was like a flashback to the mid-90s, you know, conference championship game.
Yeah.
And it was like after every whistle in someone's zone, if there was a whistle in someone's zone, there was like a 50-second to a minute wrestling match in front of the net. The guy would spray the goalie. And then you're on the blue line. You're like, should I go in there? Oh, their guy went down deep. I got to get in there too. And then you'd go in there and everyone's wrestling around. And then I was thinking, I was like, man, it was so physically tiring playing in those games because, as you know, like grappling someone and trying to move 200 pounds when they're a world-class athlete. you know, at the top of a sport. It's like, that is physically exhausting, but it was like every single whistle. You know, that's there'd be the guy that'd come in and chop the goalie, and it was just like nonstop. And I was like, man, that was so exhausting. But watching the game today, it's like I could sit here and say, oh, you know, there's not the hitting, there's not that, but you know,
it's entertaining.
Believe it.
Yeah.
The teams that play that style of game win. Like, you can go back to the 50s, 60s. The teams that are the toughest overall team.
Yeah.
Every dynasty are the Oilers of the 80s, the Islanders of the late 70s, 80s. Toughest team. You know what I mean? The Anaheim Mighty Ducks, toughest team. The Red Wings,
Florida,
one of the
now.
Toughest teams. Florida,
yeah,
one of the toughest teams. And toughness doesn't always mean fighting. It means playing hurt, taking a huge hit, sacrificing an injury to make a play. All those different aspects of what toughness is, you know, the outsider just looks at, oh, this guy only had 5 fighting majors. He wasn't tough, but I can tell you some of the toughest guys you play against were guys that really didn't fight a lot.
Well, Al, it's funny you mentioned that, because I was – listen, you're not a small guy. You talk about all the scrums. I was looking at your stats. You get a ton of PIMs, you know, 180, 169, 124, 135, 143, like a lot of PIMs in your career. And I'm like, well, he must have been fighting a lot. Then I go to your fights record, 1-1-1-1. You had a year with 8, but then back to 1-1-2-3. What were you getting all the PIMs for if you're not getting fighting majors? Because listen, the year you got 180, you had one fight, Al. One fight, and you had 180 penalty minutes.
I think that year I got the Jack the Gripper Award. They used to have this thing called the Jack the Gripper Award for most holding penalties. I think I won it in 2 months. bad refereeing.
There's no way you're getting 180 minutes of penalties with minors. He gets 90 penalties.
Yeah, there'd be the odd. I always tried to make it so it was an odd number, you know, so everyone would be like, oh, look at that, 175 fighting or 175 minutes. No, I would fight.
Okay, what's with a killer?
Like, if someone chopped my goalie, or if someone ran my partner or a teammate and I was the guy on the ice, I would fight. But not a lot of guys came after me. There was certain guys that would, you know, come after me.
Yeah.
But, you know, all my fights were against the toughest guys, though. I will say that.
I did say that. You're fighting the Craig Berubes of the world. You're fighting huge guys.
I fought the Berubes, the Probies, the Steve Smiths, the Rick Tockets.
You fought some legit guys.
Yeah. I mean, I was strong enough where, you know, I could tie a guy up and get some body position and get my face away from a cement hand. And then, and Berube ended up – I love Craig Berube. I was one of the happiest guys in the world when he got hired by Toronto, because he always used to come after me in Philly when I was in Wash. And then he got traded to Wash, and we ended up driving to the rink together my last year.
That's funny.
That I was a Capital, which was his first year. But he would always be like, "Hey, Freddy, let's go." And I'd be like, "What do you mean, let's go?" I'm like, "I'm going to get the puck and go end to end, and you're not going to catch me." "Oh, I'm going to fucking kill you, Ivory." And then I did fight him finally. And he's like, "Let's go. Let's throw him. Let go." I'm like, "You're the tough guy, man. Get loose. You throw him. You're the tough
you
guy.
Get loose."
Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. That's awesome. So you mentioned moving around Toronto to Washington, Boston, San Jose. What's the highlight of your career? And we'll touch on the All-Star game and the hard shots, hopefully in a little bit, but like, just as a player, you know, you've scored a ton of goals. You've been on great teams. You've been around great players. Is there a few moments where you look back like that was the tops, man?
There's always a lot going on. I'm on site getting the job done, running the business too, payments, invoices, admin, all on me. But now with Tap to Pay, I can take payments there and then, and Sage sorts the admin afterwards. Everything's sorted in the background, so I don't spend hours doing it later. Magic.
Sage Copilot is built with over 40 years of experience helping British businesses like Mike at Residual Electrical Contractors. That's more than artificial intelligence, that's authentic intelligence. Search Sage Copilot to learn more. T's and C's apply.
I'm Andrea, founder of a boutique handbag brand, Andy, and this is why I switched to Shopify. I tried three other platforms prior to Shopify, and I remember my breaking point was when I would try to make one little change and my entire site would go down. Shopify made it really easy for me to shift everything over and hit the ground running. I was able to migrate my products and all of my customer information over.
Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Go to shopify.com/listen to take your business to the next level today.
I really want to say, just because, like, I didn't, you know, like you said earlier, I didn't have this manifestation of I'm going to be a pro hockey player when I was 6 years old, and then everything in my life was around that. Like, I'd watch a soccer game and I'd be like, I'm going to be Pelé. I want to be Pelé today. And then I'd watch a baseball game, you know, and then I was like, I'm going to be Pete Rose, man. I'm going to get a hit every time I'm up and never get an error. And then I'd be like, I'm going to be Herschel Walker, man. I play football. I'm going to run faster and everyone, no one's going to tackle. It's like every day, I guess I had this vision of I wanted to be a great athlete, but it was never just hockey.
Yeah.
It was all the sports. And I guess that is kind of a manifestation in a roundabout way, where I was always, you know, riding my bike on Friday night when I was in ninth grade, when everyone else was going to parties all
day. No, I mean, when you're in the show, Al, what was your greatest memory when you were in the show playing for these Leafs?
Well, I was building up to the story.
Okay. Oh, you're okay. You're putting layers to this. All right. Okay.
Yeah. So for me, I didn't win a Stanley Cup. I was on teams that, 3 years in a row, I lost to the team that won the Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, two there in Pittsburgh and then one with Boston. And it was like the team that wins the Cup is the best team. Like, they're great. Everyone else is just really good. Because, like, what goes into it, as you know, having played, it's really hard to explain to somebody who hasn't played a full NHL season than a round of playoffs or rounds of playoffs. You know, after, you know, when I was playing, you'd play 10 or 12 exhibition games some years. Whew. When I first started. Yeah. So, like, what goes into it, the intangibles and how everything has to line up with injuries and trades and getting the right personnel. It's just so, everything has to be precise and dialed in for it to happen. You know, I just think that for me, it was arriving, you know, like the All-Star games, those were
great. This is a hell of a buildup, Al. I'm waiting for the payoff here.
The All-Star games were great. I would say it was before I was ever a pro.
Okay.
Playing in the Olympics.
Ah,
when it was all amateurs, you know, against the big Russian red machine.
So that was 83-84.
Yeah.
After they had just won in 1980. So what was the hype the same as it was at Lake Placid?
Oh yeah. The hype on us was huge. And, we had played Canada like 11 times, you know, touring around the world,
yep,
playing them in, yep, Alaska, playing them in Finland, blah, 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 during the touring before. And we beat them like 9 out of 11 times. And then for us to get to the medal round, they were in our pool, and we lost to them.
Oh, no.
You know, they had a good team. We had a good team, but we lost to them. And it didn't really matter because they went to the medal round, and I don't know if they scored a goal, because that's when the Czechs and the Russians and the Swedes were powerhouse, because,
yeah,
you know, we were amateurs and they were amateurs, but kind of not.
How does that work? I always thought of that when I was watching the Miracle movie. I just watched it last week, actually, with the kids. So did you just take like 3 months off of that year or 4 months and tour around and just forget about life? Because there had to be college guys on your team, right?
Oh, yeah. We set up shop, like home base was Minneapolis.
Okay.
And that's where that's like where ground zero was. And then you'd go on like a three week road trip and play all the CHL teams. Then you'd come back, train for a week or two. Then you'd go on a 3 or 4 week tour playing all the college teams.
But you're with the Windsor Spitfires at this time, right?
No, I was drafted. I was drafted, but I wasn't playing with them. I got drafted, and then I made that team, and they said, well, when you're done touring, then play junior after the Olympics.
Okay, so they let you go and just go play. And that all the college players did that too. They just paused their personal teams.
Yes, because we started in August, and then
okay,
all the way to, you know, like right now until the middle of February, the Olympics. And then after that, I went to play junior.
And where were the Olympics that year?
They were in Sarajevo, which is gone.
Oh, yeah. Bosnia, yeah, area.
It wasn't like the Olympic Villages now where it's like party central. It was,
yeah, because
it was like you left to go to your event and then you came back to your dorm and you were with a bunch of hockey players.
So you didn't get to pal around with anybody else, like no other sports or anything?
You could go to events, but yeah, there wasn't a lot of paling around. Or maybe my mindset was I wasn't in a palling around mood because we lost the first game of the Olympics to the Canadians and they were in our pool.
Yep.
Basically it was going to come down to, you know, there was four pools and whoever won their pool went to the medal round, and
yeah,
it didn't look like they were going to lose to any of the other teams because we were the top two teams.
That's funny. That's funny. All right. Let's talk about the All-Star game. Could you mention highlights? Obviously I'm an all-star as well, just like you.
Listen, right.
You're the hardest shot guy, Al. Like, I don't care what anybody says, because the sticks, they give you like a huge advantage. You're using wood sticks. Hours of training, I'm guessing you put into your shot. Hundreds and thousands of hours working in the backyard, on the ice, getting that 105 mile an hour shot. Or was it just a natural gift because you're a freak athlete?
I think it was a combination of both, but I didn't really, I worked on my shot, like the snappers and wrist shot all growing up. Like I was really into that, working on that. And I think that developed some good, you know, tendon, wrist strength, forearms, all that stuff. And I really worked on my technique, transferring the body weight.
Yeah.
Off of my back leg exploding. You know, because when I was in my prime, when I'd go to shoot a puck, I would take off like I was, you know, in the fastest skater race at the All-Star game.
Well, that probably helped a ton is your speed, yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, I was a bigger guy, and I was always in the fastest skater as well at the All-Star games. But, you know, that's definitely an advantage to be big and fast, and you're taking a slap shot. But when I got to training camp, my rookie year, it was funny because Ken Reggett and I were roommates. And after practice, I would stay out on the ice for whatever, an hour, because there was no restrictions on how long the guys can be on the rink from the Players Association or anything like that. The Players Association back then was, Your rep would call you and say, all right, they're going to call you about a vote. You're saying no. I'd be like, well, what are we voting on? They're like, don't worry about it. You're saying no. Or they'd say, you're saying yes. And that was the end of it. Be like, okay.
Oh, my gosh.
Funny. But the shooting, Ken Reggett, after practice one day, I'm hammering pucks as hard as I can. And he's like, you were a first-round pick? He takes his helmet off, takes his gloves off, puts his hand behind his hands behind his back, and I'm ripping clappers as hard as I can, and he's like kick saving him with his chest, stuff like that. So I was like, I want to shoot harder. This is kind of embarrassing.
Oh, no kidding. So he was just mocking you. I thought you were going to say you weren't hitting the net or something.
No, he was like saying, you don't shoot hard. It's kind of funny.
And so what did you do? This is your first year in the NHL.
Yeah. I just got dialed into my stick, became a stick craftsman, making the ultimate curve for a one-timer, always messing with my sticks, shaping them. You know, changing stiffness, changing shaft size, working on how my hand slides when I take a slap shot. Because my hand, my bottom hand is never consistently in one place. Like, even in a slap shot, my hand is sliding up and down and doesn't really grasp the stick hard until the moment of contact when I've followed through. That's when I'll clamp down and leverage the stick to use the stick. But Ken Reggett, my roomie, you know, was making fun of me, and that kind of got me a little motivated where I was like, man, I got to shoot the puck harder than this. This is kind of stupid. He's got his gloves and his helmet off. He's not worried about the shot.
And then fast forward 5 years later, you rip a 105 in the All-Star game and everybody goes berserk. And that's like, that is the ally afraid everybody's known about. And it's all thanks to Ken Reggett giving you a hard time.
That's right, Mikey, Kenny Reggett. Yeah, but, you know, when I got to, like, at that moment in time, when I got to that All-Star game, I figured I knew I had a good chance. I knew it was between me and Al MacInnis and me. And what I really wanted to win was the fastest skater, because that was the first ever skills contest that 93. It was 1990 in Pittsburgh, that All-Star game.
Yeah.
And I wanted to win that. But there was a different scenario where it's they don't do the time for one lap. It was a speed trap where they trapped your miles per hour through the neutral zone.
No kidding.
So you'd start at the red line, and then as you came around the net, they did a speed trap from blue line to blue line.
Yeah.
To capture your time. And Mike Gartner beat me, which – you know, he's definitely one of the greatest skaters ever. But I knew I was going to have a good chance with the shot because I was a fast skater and I was scoring a lot of goals at the time and I was blowing them by goalies. So I figured, all right, this thing must be moving pretty good.
Oh, yeah. That's cool, man. Al, I appreciate that because I had a terrible shot for a tall guy. I watched Chara. He's ripping him 106 and I barely got to 100. I think my max is like 101, 100. But for my size, I should have just been bombing them with the sticks that I have. Are you kidding me? My stiffness. I had a 130 flex. I should have just been ripping them. Was that my problem? Too
stiff
of a stick?
Too stiff. Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah.
Not enough whip. Damn it. If I would have had you training me, I would have been a lot better. But what are you going to do?
Yeah, you probably would have been.
So what do you – what you're such a prick. So what's next for Al? You're the coolest guy ever. How do you not work for a team? You see all these teams, they got the ambassadors, they got this, they got that. Why doesn't Toronto just have you in at the rink all the time? Just around the guys, shaking hands, kissing babies.
That's a good question.
You're the best guy ever.
Oh, that's nice of you, John. I don't know. I don't know why, but I mean,
yeah,
I guess because I
have some questions
really,
that don't have answers.
Yeah. And I mean, I really have never campaigned to try and do that. I've never like expressed a big interest to do that. I think a lot of it is because, you know, I feel like when I retired, I think you kind of got to start edging your way in. You got to start trying to facilitate a transfer into the management side of things
right away.
Where I was always a guy that was like a pro players association. You know, I was like the anti-management guy. Not in a bad way.
Yeah.
But like there was, they knew who I was. They knew I was kind of a guy who beat, you know, went to the beat of his own drummer, but, you know, still was within the guidelines and, you know, being a respectful teammate, employee and all that. But I definitely kind of did my own thing.
Well, we lost Ally Frady, it looks like. But anyways, that was a great call from Ally. I appreciate him being on. I'll call him in a second and say no worries about that. But thank you, everybody, for listening. I appreciate the support, and we will be back next week. Have a good weekend, everybody. Cheers.
Looking for a new job? Just go to Indeed and Bob's your uncle. Except we don't really care who your uncle is. Sorry, Uncle Bob. Instead of who you know, we want you to show off what you know. Indeed lets you put your skills and experience front and center so you can match with jobs that fit your talents, not your family tree. Download the Indeed app and start making the world work better for you. Today.
Your Starbucks is ready. Beans ground, milk frothed, shots pulled. Velvety milk poured into a double shot of dark perfection and... oof, that's the good stuff. The baristas are ready. The finest coffee beans are ready. The Starbucks you love is ready. Hello again from the Starbucks Coffee Company.